Welcome to the Experience Focused Leaders Podcast. My name is Alex Shevelenko. I'm CEO and founder of Relate2, and we are on a mission, both with the podcast and with Relate2, to bring the most important ideas to life. And how do we do that? We do that through amazing, immersive, engaging experiences that move your organization forward, move your customers forward, and move us as a society forward. So if you love ideas, if you love bringing these ideas to life, stick around. Also, at the end of the podcast, we'll reveal how you could potentially be a guest speaker on the podcast as well. Let's get started. Welcome to Experience Focused Leaders. I am delighted to have a very special episode with our guest, Professor Herman Simon, founder and honorary chairman of Simon Kucher, one of the world's leading strategy, marketing, and pricing consultancies. And on top of being a founder of a thriving organization, Mr. Simon is also a thought leader. He's written 35 books and, in German-speaking world, the only thought leader who is rated higher than he is somebody who is sort of the definer of the management thinker genre, Peter Drucker. So welcome to the podcast, Herman. Excited to have you on board.
Alex, thanks for inviting me, and I look forward to our discussion.
Well, I'm a longtime fan of the firm that you've built. I want to say that first, I was a consultant back in the days, and at some point we competed. And when we were at SuccessFactors and ultimately SAP, we were using Simon Kucher's approach to pricing. And we were pretty much only used two consulting firms. One was McKinsey for some things, and you were the other one. And so I have deep respect for the depth and sophistication that you've developed in your business. Obviously, you expanded beyond pricing to all sorts of ways to driving profitable growth. And I would love to hear maybe why start with pricing when you did. What did you see that the rest of the consulting industry, the rest of the world didn't see when you got started and moved from academia into consulting?
You can start from two sides. One is the knowledge-driven side. The other is the market opportunity side. Okay. I clearly started from the knowledge-driven side. Okay. The decisive crossroad was when I decided on the topic of my doctoral dissertation in 1973. And the topic was pricing strategies for new products. But that was very theoretical, far from any practical application or consulting. But then I had some aha experiences. In 1979, I visited Professor Philip Kotler, the famous marketing guru. I'm doing pricing research. I have the ambition to create an impact on practice. And every young scientist has this ambition and nobody achieves that. And then he said, but I know one guy in Chicago who calls himself price consultant. And the light went up. Can you make a living from being a price consultant? Mm-hmm. A second influence was Peter Drucker. He was a friend of mine for many years. I visited him a couple of times in Los Angeles. And he said, focus on pricing in your consulting. Nobody covers this. And that's how we started in 1985. Together with my first doctoral student, Eckhard Kutscher, that's why the company is called Simon Kucher. We never expected that we would reach this global scale. We have now 2,200 people. Our revenue last year was $678 million. So we are not as big as McKinsey, but in our niche, we are the global market leader.
Absolutely. And when I was researching for our own business, what is For example, pricing and market access, this work is in pharma, as an example. I just want to say I went and went to your website and did the research and got smarter on the topic. So there's a lot of tremendous thought leadership that is not just across a single vertical or single kind of some horizontal thing. It obviously pricing varies by industries. And so I really appreciate that depth that you put together. So if you had to now take a step back and find something that across your experience in building this particular discipline, what is it that most people don't appreciate about pricing that you've unlocked for countless client engagements? And so maybe you could share that nugget that will make somebody who, even if they don't listen beyond this, they're gonna get their insight on pricing for the rest of their lives.
Most pricing today is still cost driven, sense of cost plus the costs I know, and I apply a certain margin on that. And the second most important factor in practice is competitive pricing. I see what the competitive prices are and adjust myself to it in some way. And both approaches miss the decisive point of pricing.
Mm.
The decisive factor is the value, or more precisely, the value perceived by our customers or potential customers. And the Romans were smart. In their Latin language, they have the same word for value and price, namely precium, like in precious. So the fundamental eternal equation of pricing is value equals premium equals price. I must understand the value my customers perceive, because this value defines their willingness to pay. Mercedes is just introducing a new S-Class. They must understand what is the value of the S-Class relative, say, to BMW or an Audi or a new Chinese model with all features. And this defines their optimal pricing. If I'm 20% higher in value, I can afford to charge a higher price. If I'm equal to value, I have to adjust to competitive prices. If I'm lower in value, I have to ask a lower price. So the core of pricing of our competence as Simon Kutcher's is to understand and to quantify the value.
Yeah.
It doesn't help you if you know I'm better than the competition. Are you 5, 10, 15% better? That defines your possibility to ask a higher price. So approaching pricing from a value point is a fundamental difference compared to many practices of today.
So to build on that, one word that you said that I think easy to get lost, but it's really important in our world of, from relate to AI and communications perspective, is perceived value.
Yes.
Let's double down that, because there's obviously perception in terms of communications about that value. Then there is the actual, attribution, fundamental attribution of what we're counting in that from a, maybe fundamental psychological approaches. So what constitutes perception of value separate from the value itself?
Yeah. I think it starts with understanding the value system of your customer. So that's even before research and development, before creating the product, that you understand the value system, the attributes which are highly and not so highly valued. The second step is to create value. That's a challenge to research and development. And also to deliver this value at reasonable, at competitive costs. Then the big challenge, communicating value, comes. How do you communicate it? That is can be very, very complicated, for instance, for software where people do not experience, cannot experience before they actually use it.
Purchased it,
and,
right.
And then there is a fourth step, retaining value. For instance, if you look at cars, the second-hand value of a car has a very strong effect on the initial willingness to pay. If you know your car is still very valuable after 5 years when you want to resell it, or if it loses 40% of the value in the first year, your willingness to pay for a new car is very strongly affected by this retained value. So understanding the value system of the customer, creating the value, communicating it, and retaining it.
Okay, so we got these four brackets. Now let's park the world of consumer, because we can probably understand that, or maybe we use that as one of the examples. And then there's the world of B2B / enterprise. And I think there's a lot of research that says, well, look, we should at this point start, at least certainly in software, start looking at individual B2B buyers also as consumers, right? Because they're consumers in their real world, and you know, they're expecting certain things from their B2B vendors as they would from consumers, particularly maybe around communications. There's a clarity around there, expectation. But what do you see as the biggest divide between the consumer world? You know, if you want, we could separate CPG from large ticket items, but it, like, and these sort of the B2B enterprise universe.
There's one big divide. That's in B2B, that economic indicators are very important. If you buy a machine, a system, for instance, energy consumption, maintenance costs, etc., play a very big role. And in many cases, you can calculate these. You have information on these costs. On the consumer side, psychological factors are much more important. If you think of the extreme case of luxury goods, it's only luxury brand actually supported by a high price. It can be design. If in your home you want furniture which looks nice, etc. So there, psychological factors play a much bigger role, less pure economic factors. That is the big divide. And that relates then also directly to our communication. In B2B, most of the sales are through personal selling, through salespeople, and they have to convince the customer that this machine purchase or whatever it is delivers an economic advantage in terms of cost, of reliability, of lifetime, etc. On the consumer side, much of the communication is not directly related to the technical features of the product. It can be, for instance, for electric cars, it seems that the range of the car, also the second-hand price, electric cars lose a lot of value in the first 2 years, play an important role, the time you need to recharge the batteries. But for a luxury product, it's very different. There, the technical features are unimportant relative to the prestige value the
brand,
the product
prestige
conveys. So it's a very different world between B2B and B2C.
Let's double click on this, and I think maybe this will help our audience to see where this boundary and how do we think about this. So there's this famous saying, nobody gets fired for buying IBM. that's been around in the industry. There's another kind of history of, you know, many B2B organizations would say something like, if you our customers that bought, you know, our platform got a promotion, we managed to get them, you know, speaking at a conference, or like somebody like us, like, hey, come and join us and tell your story on our podcast. Yeah. Right. And I think I would say it comes from a good place, right? Like you know, as a founder of a relatively young company, you know, I genuinely value the people that place trust in us. And I want to make sure that we take care of them, right? Like we are enabling their success, their organization success. You know, in our case, we enable them to succeed with their customers sometime. So I think there's this genuine psychological connection as well in B2B, because it's not some abstract, 40-year-old lady that's buying Gucci bag. It's like, it's somebody that we know, we generally picky enough to do business with people we like as well in many B2B organizations. And so there is this much deep, ironically, there's a much deeper human connection, one-on-one connection. And I think that flavors a perception of value, trust. So how do we combine that with, you know, at the same time, hey, you have this company economic hat and quantitative hat with this deeply human connection?
Yeah. You address some very, very important points in B2B relations. And they are more important today than they were 50 years ago. Why? Mm. Because we have more products and services where we have limited information.
Mm.
If you adopt a software system, a new production system, you don't have complete information, even as a business. You cannot just test it 5 years and then decide whether you have to make a decision now which artificial intelligence system you adopt for your company. So you have very limited.
So the world is moving fast. There's not enough data in the world where there's a lot of data. There's not enough data on the actual outcomes.
Yeah. And you have to decide rather quickly. Mm-hmm. You cannot say, okay, I will shag it for 3 years and then decide. Right. So we decided a year ago or so to adopt a specific AI system, and that was under limited information. So what are you doing as the vendor and as the customer in this situation? Mm-hmm. There are two very essential aspects. One is references.
Mm.
As a vendor, you use references that this company applied that. For instance, at Simon Kucher, we have more than 40 unicorns in the Silicon Valley. That's an extreme value communication tool to other customers who are in these businesses. The second is, you trusted the people, the relation. Can you trust the representative of the vendor? So can you trust our consultants? Are they competent? So it's a direct interpersonal build up of goodwill, of trust, of reputation, which is very, very important. And you could say the less information you can have on the product, on service, the more important these two factors become: references and personal relationship and trust. So that's part of the value. And you could say that's also, to a certain degree, psychological, because you think that if Google or Apple accepted this product or service, it must be good. So the value of the reference depends on the reputation of the company which adopted the product. And the second, the human relation that has another interesting effect. During COVID-19, our business actually went very well with existing customers because they knew us, they trusted us. So personal meetings, personal interaction was not that important. You could do it digitally. But now we see to build up new client relationships, you have to meet in person. So right. Our consultants, our partners say we have learned that digital cannot replace the personal encounter. And I think that's
so this is in the consulting
true for the trust.
For the trust-based decision.
Okay. Based decision.
So let's say, and it's interesting because you have almost two businesses, right? Like the primary consulting business. And we were talking about earlier where you have a specialty business where you can create this pricing engine or ROI calculation engine. And that's sort of a software tool that you could introduce in the market. Congratulations on the latest IDC rankings on that.
Yeah, we had a top ranking on IDC. Yeah.
So do you see a big difference between these two businesses? One which is a little bit more, structured, product based, right? Like probably still consultative selling, but there's this core IP element in there that doesn't change from client to client, and then there's this sort of the consultative relationship where you really need to get much deeper into strategy of the organization and, support that move. Like, how do you think about those two?
Of course, the knowledge we need in these two phases of the value chain, developing the concept and then implementing the concept in the customer's IT system. The knowledge we need there is different, but it's part of an integrated value chain. So you could say by creating Simon Kucher Engine, we have moved downstream in the value chain, and it's actually necessary today. If you bring only the concept to your client and leave the client alone with implementing it, you are in a weak position.
That's
because
right.
Especially big companies, they say we can do both. And so we are very happy that we extended this value chain. And I said our total revenue is a little over $678 million. And Simon Kucher Engine, after 2 years, already has a revenue of over $20 million, which is also not negligible, and it's recurring revenue.
So we
support our clients over time to run these systems, and these systems, the pricing module is integrated into the bigger IT infrastructure of our clients. And we do that very frequently in banks, financial services, retailers, etc.
So I guess where I would like to take us is this dimension of allowing the technology to help customers experience value faster, right? Because the perception is that the more the sort of the bigger the consultative, the big project, great. Like, yes, you can build trust to communicate that, and really understand the business levers and deliver on that ultimately. But what if you could have the best of both worlds, right? Like have the experience of this luxury bag that makes you feel great, maybe present a great pricing solution faster in your organization and just kind of experience the value was less risk, so to speak. And it feels like there's a lot of AI businesses that are sort of trying to do that. Hey, we can, trust us, but by the way, we could deliver this project faster. A lot of them are failing at this. So there's going to be a lot of mess, I think, ultimately, or they're doing pilots, but not translating the pilots into real deployments. Mm-hmm. But if this is something that's happening, I think the pressure is that it takes a while to build that trusted relationship. Not everybody can do it. And yet it's much easier to start building some kind of products. And so the world gets noisy. And there's a lot of messages out there. And so if you don't have an established brand, you could try to, get the product out there and hope that this will kind of overcome established trusted brands. How do you see kind of emerging companies deal with this, where they don't have maybe fully trusted relationships yet, but they have ability to roll out a B2B product almost in a consumer-like fashion, targeting the needs of individuals, and then maybe working their way back up into the C-suite.
That's a whole bag of issues. I would emphasize again the foundation of our success, of success in general, that you understand the value attributes, the value expectations of your customers, and try to meet them. So the challenge of innovation is not to develop a technical super product or service, but to integrate customer needs and technology. And I'm every day annoyed by the complexity of many IT systems. That so I have to basically ask our experts to help them. So
it's like me-centric. What you're saying is you need to start with the customer.
I am a great tech expert, and I developed the best product with all the features, the Swiss Army knife with 50 features, and the client needs only 5 of those. But it increases complexity. So my first recommendation for a newcomer startup would be try to align what you offer to your customer needs. For instance, to the ability of the customer to handle complexity. Very, very important. And I'm also not talking of consumers, but of
B2B.
Even in my car, I counted the buttons. I have 150 buttons in the interior of the car.
Probably
for 30 of them, I don't know what their function is. I may not need them, but if you run a computer or even on the smartphone, something changes and you need an expert to help you. So first, integrate customer needs and technology. The second is, and that is also a big challenge. We are in early stage. How do you apply artificial intelligence? And I would say, as the IDC study proves, we seem to be pretty at the front of this, but still most of our applications are relatively simple but useful. Let me give you two examples. We did a study for a fast food chain in Germany, and the question was, under which conditions are sales promotions most effective? So we put all data you can imagine, population data, data on cities, weather, sports, into the system. And you know what came out as the most effective event time for promotions? When there is a Bundesliga game in the city. Bundesliga is the first soccer league in Germany. Nobody would ever have thought of this. We would not, but AI found it out. A similar case in the US, a retail company with many stores. They have dynamic pricing in the evening for perishable goods, bread, fruit, etc. And they noticed that these dynamic pricing is very different from city to city. Again, all data into the system. What came out? If there are a lot of street and road construction sites in the city, the dynamic pricing doesn't work. And that's intuitive.
So it's basically what you're saying is that, and this is,
but
this
never
is
your, never anybody would have
never would have guessed
that
it, right?
Manually. So these are just two simple examples. It's still in the data, not in the really analytical or decision phase, but this shows how powerful artificial intelligence can be in detecting effects. And the next step will, of course, be to adjust prices, to consumer preferences, segmentation, multi-dimensional pricing structures, etc. But I would say we are leading, but we are still in a very early stage.
Yeah, it's very interesting. We see from our perspective, like this evolution of like many organizations are so far behind on even getting basic analytics about what people are paying attention to, right? Like, so outside of the digital channels, where that's a little bit more accepted that you will look at people looking at the pricing page. Let's say we go into the B2B world, most of the proposals and sales presentations are delivered in a way where there is very little feedback loop about happens, right? Like, maybe you'll catch somebody's body language if you're meeting in person, but most important decision makers are not even there with you in person. And we have roughly zero digital body language of, you know, what do they care about, right? And you said, like, there is a lot of, where the customer perceives value. Well, unfortunately, in most B2B organizations, by definition, there's many stakeholders. And so imagine the world where you could see at a minimum where the attention is of various stakeholders. So you could start understanding where are you succeeding in communicating value, where your people never get to the price page, you know, in your proposal, right? What do they skip straight through and miss the important value components, right? And then how do you, and that's a problem as well, right? Because then it becomes, to your point, a kind of a competitive decision versus, you know, a way to capture the business value that you're creating. But the underlying theme that we see is that the standard way of communicating has not changed fundamentally in decades, right? People are still showing up with something that is, you know, not trackable fully, not really understood. And so the my question to you is, what are you seeing that's becoming, you know, maybe improving in how larger organizations, most innovative organizations, are taking a different approach at capturing the value, the attention, so that they could then reflect back and apply better proposals, right? Or change how they communicate value, how they, you know, maybe what they emphasize in the sales journeys.
I would not fully agree with what you said, because we are getting much better information on the communication, on the information habits of our customers. And I would say,
in B2B,
this area, I explain it, this area is so complex that we need artificial intelligence to interpret it. Let me give you an example. Mercedes is just introducing the new S-Class. Mm-hmm. So I read a newspaper article in the main German national daily. There's no feedback. They don't know whether I read the newspaper article. Neither the newspaper nor Mercedes knows it. Mm. But then I went into the homepage of Mercedes and looked at certain features. For instance, for me, an interesting point is the length of the car, the engine, the energy consumption, etc. And if they capture this information for many customers, this gives them a foundation to segment the market better, to address customers, etc. And my impression from a different field, I'm just working on the American edition of my German book, Simon Says. These are my most valuable experience from 50 years. And what I do, I write the chapter in English, and then I ask artificial intelligence, when the chapter is on competition or pricing or leadership, did I miss any aspect? And the artificial intelligence usually gives me two or three aspects which I miss, which are very interesting. I said, I
Right.
want original, unusual, surprising. I don't know how the system does that, but it really gives me additional information. So I see that I personally use AI as a tool to be more efficient, to do things faster, say to get faster summary of a text or a book, and to improve my quality, what I offer to my readers,
your
or
audience.
Listeners. And this is, in my opinion, a huge opportunity for better communication and marketing. If, say, they find Mercedes finds from the visits to their S-Class page 1,000 customers who are similar to me, they could address them with very specific information.
Yeah.
For instance, there was a photo with the new S-Class painted in gold in the leading German national. I wrote a mail to the CEO and say, how can you present the S-Class in gold? That's totally contradictory to the typical preference of an S. And he said that was only a test model and it happened to come into. So they get, if they use this information in an intelligent, which I do not know, they would get much better points, content to communicate to the
well, we don't
target
disagree.
Segments, not to everybody, to target
to
segments
that target segment.
Much better.
Yeah, we don't disagree. I think what you're highlighting is these two examples. They're, let's say, different continuum. So Mercedes obviously still B2C ultimately, although premium, you know, high ticket item. There's enough volume there to capture that data. And then you're talking about the authoring experience, which I think is absolutely great, but it's not the same as getting the feedback from the actual readers.
That's true. That is true. But it's only one step before. One step before, because what does the artificial intelligence do? I give it the keyword leadership. And I say, I want some very current topics on leadership. And the system looks into the internet and finds 3 points which I have not covered in my text so far. So I would say what the system finds on the internet is also to a certain degree of reflection of
the reflection of the zeitgeist,
being,
at
being
least
discussed, being topical there. And that even goes further. And that's a somewhat strange experiment. I don't know whether it will make sense or work. Some researchers have done the following. They said it's very costly and time-consuming to ask customers about their price responses, their price reactions. So why don't we ask ChatGPT? And so they did the following, people from Harvard. They asked ChatGPT questions about how it would react to price changes for toothpaste. They used toothpaste as an example. They kept one competitive price stable and then changed the price. And what you got was a demand function. Whether that's valid or nonsense,
to be determined,
I don't
know.
But it practically costs nothing. When you ask 1,000 customers, that costs a lot and takes a lot of time. So this could also a new approach to draw from the internet what customers said about their reactions to different prices.
Well, at a minimum, you could certainly expand the from a small N, you could extrapolate to a larger N with this,
plus,
right?
We need comparisons from real studies with real customers to what the internet says. And
to the inter-
it may be nonsense. It may be close to reality. I have no idea what the eventual outcome is.
I love it. And I think what you're highlighting is this brave new world where AI is obviously an asset, where I think we still see what our customers are saying is that in that world, there's still a big divide between improving the creating content, which is what you're kind of describing, and like at scale content, like the Mercedes website experience, and then one-to-one insights. So that's sort of where I think we see a lot of opportunities to combine, for example, your pricing tools with actually capturing that are very B2B, right? Like that don't have the large scale or communication of value, and then seeing, well, okay, so or when it's, let's say, even a page on a presentation, right? Like as something example of that. Let's say that presentation is allows you to interact with it, right? Like there is explainers, there is video that explains it, or you could click on certain buttons. Just like you would that do that on a Mercedes at a large scale, you know, website deployment. Imagine now you could do this at a one-to-one or very much one-to-few cases. And I think that's beautiful as technology allows us to do that now. And so I think that's where we see the data insight that historically has been left in the consumer marketing world. We're seeing some of our most innovative customers bring that into the, you know, high stakes one-to-one B2B world. And I think ability to, for example, have a tool like your price calculator together with a presentation that maybe explains the context, starts becoming a more comprehensive system where you start seeing how does the audience engage in this one-to-few context. And often the audience, as you know, sometimes it's external, like the customers, but there's oftentimes a lot of internal customers as well that help, you know, champions, you know, influencers that helps you make that decision. So we're seeing from this perceived value perspective that we talked about earlier, what used to be on trust and kind of the purely kind of intuitive factors, there's now a lot more data that's coming in that allows us to at least understand, hey, how strong is our relationship here? Or is this even communicated clearly? And I think again, AI is one of the we could feed that into AI and it helps us say, hey, based on these analytics, and based on what has worked before, if I wanted to put together a new proposal hub for somebody or a new onboarding hub for a customer, what would the solution be? We call this regenerative AI, where you're taking in that data and building it in. But I what I'm intrigued by is if you've seen great examples of this happening in this sort of high stakes one-on-one world, because that's where we see the biggest gap right now, because it hasn't been there historically. That's one thing we can probably
That's
agree on.
absolutely true. I think there are two components. One is more data, but data as such has no value.
Has
You
no
have
value on
to
its own.
interpret them, to analyze them, to understand them. And that's artificial intelligence. So we have more data, and we have now the tool to disaggregate the data to translate them into real understanding. But then one fundamental question remains. We have the so-called IT productivity paradox. In spite of the huge investments in information technology over the last 30, 40 years, overall productivity has hardly increased. How can that be? There's nobody has a convincing explanation for that. One hypothesis is that we move from more productive industrial jobs to less productive service jobs, but there are certain sectors, banking, etc., where productivity has increased, but overall productivity has practically not increased in the labor
Yeah, that's very
productivity in
it's
spite
interesting
of.
despite this. So if we're about 50, like 50s to 70s, there was a big, very strong lift, or like and then from 70s on,
It's very, very
it's a
small,
like a
very
big fat
small.
zero. Yeah, very minor compared
In
to
Germany, for instance, since 1990, labor productivity increased with 0.5%, 0.5% per year. That's practically nothing. It's adding up over time, but relative to these huge investment. And now, what is the fundamental question? Will that change with artificial intelligence? Will it be different with artificial intelligence? Nobody knows. Right now, many of the artificial intelligence companies are disappointed because they cannot really monetize the value they are offering. Their perceived value is high. The perceived value of the customer is obviously not so high. Otherwise, they would be willing to pay more. So this is a fundamental question which I cannot answer. Nobody can answer it. We will see it in 10 years. I think for certain sectors, people who deal with data, journalists, texts, etc., we will see a productivity increase. Will we see a productivity increase in manufacturing? That depends probably more on not only software, but on robots, on automation. Can we transfer the data into action, into physical action?
Yes.
For instance, will we have trucks driven by robots in 10 years from now, or will there still be human drivers on trucks?
Right.
Nobody knows. I have no idea. I just a few months ago, I tested an autonomous vehicle in San Francisco, and that convinced me from Waymo.
Yeah.
So I became from a skeptic to somebody who accepts this. We shall see what's happening.
Well, on that note, so one of the areas that we focus on was many of our customers on regulated industries, so insurance, pharma, and health and life sciences world, or even energy and infrastructure sector, which is again sometimes government ownership, always a lot like a strong regulatory compliance heavy environment where you can't take too many risks, and. I'm curious, both with regards to your view on AI opportunities, because a lot of these industries are maybe lagging historically on usage of AI, but also on the pricing component. So they tend to be either, government type of cost plus, right? But or incredibly complex, and I'm thinking of, insurance, both complex products for people to make sense of and not very intuitive pricing decisions. So how do you see the regulated verticals? We could pick one or two. How are they adapting to this new world? What do you see is going to be the biggest changes in this sort of historically slow to change industries?
Regulation plays a very important role. For instance, when I think of financial services, two departments which often question new ideas, are opposed to new ideas in financial services, is the legal compliance department and the IT department. Because I say that's not allowed, and the same is true in energy, in public transportation, etc. So from an application of artificial intelligence point of view, from a pricing point of view, you could develop more innovative features than you get accepted by regulation. And the question is, are these industry being deregulated? Yeah, some depends from country to country, there's not a big change in deregulation, and that is constraining.
That's constraining the innovation
of every new method.
What we found with our customers is this is I'm wearing my hat, and I'm curious what your reaction is. I don't know how we could take it. Is we found that one of the ways to create momentum in the regulated verticals for customers is to reduce complexity so that the buyer, the customer, sometimes maybe the regulator themselves, has a clear picture of the offering. And That's very tricky because to do that at scale, you can't just go like even like a doc, like a lot of these industries have documents and insurance. There's a policy, it's a PDF, it's not a website. And the moment you start creating a website, the meaning could change. And because it's a blessed document, you have to go through another approval cycle. It's even more significant issue in pharma because of the risk. So it's hard to, historically, it's been hard to even do at scale, more modern, more engaging communications. And so we found using AI, an ability to keep something that's compliant, but at the same time, easy to understand, easy to make a decision on and perceive the value to your point, is sort of one of the levers. And it sort of does, bypasses the regulatory change, right? The regulatory capture dimension and sort of just accelerates and creates more modern consumer pressure on these industries. Some of our customers are innovating on that and getting an advantage. Sort of they're hidden champions in their vertical. So we that's sort of one hypothesis on how you could bring change in regulated verticals is stay compliant, but use technology to streamline the consumer. Become more consumer-like or streamline, buyer understanding. I'm curious if you're seeing anything else that we could bring to customers or like some other innovative customers are working on.
Bureaucracy is right now the hottest issue in Germany. And I would
Okay.
not confine the bureaucracy problem to the state, but it also applies to large corporations. I think the only way to deal with this problem is that you reduce both the paragraphs and the people who create these paragraphs. If you reduce only the paragraphs but leave the people, they will create new regulations. If you reduce the people and leave the regulations, people will come back because they need to implement them. And I regrettably, I'm not too optimistic that a lot is happening on that
So you
front.
can you say human nature and organizational systems are
It's
not as quick to change.
very
Yeah.
inert, rigid structures. And when I think I am client of a large bank in Germany, it's a nightmare. Every time I come with some request, it's a bureaucratic nightmare. I have to sign forms, etc. But you see that some companies are changing. Let me give you one example. I recently talked to the CEO of Bayer, the pharmaceutical company. He said we reduced our workforce by 13,500 people. I would guess that's about 10% or so, mostly in middle management. And our goal was not so much cost reduction because they gave very generous amounts to the
Redundancy.
people who left. But now everything is going faster because we have fewer levels, fewer people who have
Yes.
to prove something, who extend discussions, etc. So I think you must reduce the workforce in these large organizations to become faster, to be better in adopting new methods. And that has to go parallel on the state side and on the corporate side.
Got
And
it. So
let me
this
add you one
digital,
other
yeah.
point on this, which may be surprising. I was in China a couple of weeks ago, and I go to conference, give speeches, and listen to the speeches of the Chinese speakers. The Chinese speakers had only one topic, innovation, with emphasis on the speed of translating research results into marketable products. So this seems to be a specific strength of the Chinese, speed from
Speed to
research
market.
to market. And this is certainly one of our weaknesses. We need, and if the public administration is involved, has to give certificates, permissions to build something, new industry, to develop new industrial land. it takes years to build a new road or a railway. And I think in that regard, we can learn from the Chinese. Speed of implementation from research, from science to market.
Interesting. So here you're seeing the sort of the Chinese example. I think obviously US is going through a lot of change, you know, from Silicon Valley historically being relatively fast. But I think there's a new administration that's, I think, part of their velocity, part of the approach is to add
or
disruptive
deregulate.
Almost velocity, deregulate, and with a view to add velocity and quicker execution parameters. But I think that, and you're saying in Europe, there isn't that catalyst of a new administration. But there's over time, there's a lot of market pressure for Europe to accelerate. Is
the
that, you know, the
pressure is strong? What is actually happening in politics is disappointing.
Okay. So the pressure is there, but the response to pressure you don't see.
Yeah, you have countervailing forces. For instance, in Germany, you have the Christian Democrats who push, and you have the Social Democrats who are breaking. And this balance means that we move very, very quite slowly.
Well, as we wrap up our discussion, which has been enlightening, but let's come back to how I introduced you, your friend Peter Drucker, right? You've seen every management trend over you know, a few decades. You've created a few, including in Germany, kind of hidden champions, promoting that movement. What are some of the one or two observations that you have of like what has changed fundamentally over the last few decades, and you know, to the discussion of ours right now, maybe what's not changing, what's staying the same, and you know, maybe there's some good or bad of this, right? Like there's something that's like some of the changes are maybe problematic, and some are great, and some things that are staying the same are great, and maybe some are problematic. So if we have this 2x2, you know, maybe that could be some nuggets that our audience could take away from your perspective of multi-decades.
When I look back at the last 3, 4, 5 decades, the biggest change has been for me globalization. Globalization has been the driver of growth. Also very impressive, the innovation we have seen. 40 years ago, we had no internet. 15 years ago, we had no artificial intelligence. So we see a lot of breakthrough innovations. The biggest problem, the mother of all problems in a macro economic and political sense is for me, demography. And in all Western countries, in most Asian countries like China, Japan, Korea, we have extremely low fertility rate. So we have aging societies. And these problems are not solvable internally because there are simply too few women today who can still bear children. So immigration is our only solution for this problem. But there I say, we need more immigration, but from the right kind, and we need less immigration from the wrong kind. We would even have to go to countries like India and build up large recruiting organizations. We had that from Germany in Eastern Europe in the 1950s. When we attracted these the guest workers from Italy, Spain, Portugal, also Turkey, we have to manage the job of integration better to avoid ghettos, etc. So this is, in my opinion, demography is the mother of all problems. Pensions, too few young people. Old people don't buy furniture or new washing machines. So this is the root of all our very big long-term problems. It's the only way to solve it is to manage migration in a different way.
So this is a macro perspective. And now if we switch on a kind of on the management thinking point of view, And I'm curious, what is your rated as top 50 thought leaders in business management all the time? Like, what do you see? Are there certain cycles of ideas that keep coming back? Is there a fundamental shift in what is accepted as kind of standard practices of how we think about management, or not? Because a lot of people are like, if I should read one management book, right? Like, or if I should focus on one area, where am I going to get the biggest value? Because there's a lot of, like, it's easy to create
Yeah,
ideas. How do you focus on
I
the
give
quality?
two recommendations.
Yes.
The first is to stay deep. What does that mean? The strongest part of the German economy are the hidden champions, and they are extremely deep in their knowledge of technology, of customer processes, etc. I call that deep tech. You
They're
don't
specialized. They're
see
specialized. Yeah.
it. High tech, you see the iPhone of Apple, but you don't know that there are 567 suppliers from Germany in the Apple iPhone. Can you imagine that?
I didn't know that. That's great.
567. Just one example. Tesa, that's a manufacturer of glues of adhesives, they supply 19 different glues for the iPhone alone. And Henkel supplies 50 different glues for the iPhone. So these are very, very deep, complex value chains. And our home is there from the German perspective, not so much in the mass consumer markets. So stay deep. And the second is speed up. Make your pro innovation processes faster. We have the
Focus and
knowledge.
velocity.
We must stay deep, and we must be faster. Our
Brilliant.
toughest competitors are the Chinese, and they are faster. We see it in electric cars, for instance.
So for our listeners who want to rapidly get more of your wisdom, Herbert, where can they find you online, or what's the best way to connect with your latest books and discover that?
The simplest way is to go to hermansimon.com. That's my homepage. You find the current information, you find the books. Herman, one R, two double N, hermansimon.com.
Amazing. Herman, thank you so much for your time with us today.
Alex, I very much enjoyed our very multifaceted deep discussion. Thank you very much.
Welcome back. Alex Shevelenko here. Thank you so much for listening to Experience Focused Leaders podcast. You can learn more about us at podcast.relato.com, RELYTO.com. Obviously, we would love for you to send this to people that you know who would be great speakers, or just share the nuggets that you took away from this episode with your community on social. And you could learn more about what we're up to on relato.com. You could certainly connect with me on LinkedIn, where it's just very easy to spell my name. You have to have a master's in Ukrainian. It's Shevelenko, Shevelenko. Would love to connect so that we can move together the way the world communicates about its most important ideas. Thank you for listening. We hope to see you next time.